Well, I'd like us just to reflect for a moment or two on some of those responses to Jesus being born. It's very interesting, or it would be very interesting, if we could just play out on a big video screen the kind of things that were going through our minds coming to this service this evening. We were actually going to have something on the screen. I don't know if any of you have caught up yet on the Facebook nativity that's been going around by email. So we're going to have it this evening right at the beginning, but then the technical things weren't working, and then it was going to come on later, and the technical things weren't working again, so we've missed it. But do go and have a look, if you can, at Facebook Nativity. You'll find it on YouTube or whatever. And that gives just a very interesting take on the reactions of people to the news that Jesus was going to be born of a virgin, and the kind of way in which people, some of them were happy, but others backed off from the whole thing. And those two kind of reactions characterize what was in our last reading about the Magi, the wise men, kings, call them what they will, who came to visit Jesus. In that story, there are two very different and two very clear reactions to Jesus being born. The first, of course, is the reaction of the Magi themselves. Magi is just the plural of magus, and magus is where we get the word magic from, a magician. These men were certainly very educated and intelligent men. They were men of independent means. They could afford not to work but make a long journey to another country. They were men of influence and learning, and one of the things that Magi were involved with was reading the stars. And on this particular occasion, there was a sign in the skies at night, the confluence of two stars. The astrologers will tell us, the astronomers will tell us all the details of it. It's a known phenomenon. And as happens when you track on a journey a star, it goes ahead of you. But they recognized that this was a sign not simply of something that was happening in some vague sense, onto which would be attached all sorts of fears and superstitions. They recognized a very specific sign in this. And what they recognized was that a king had been born, which in itself is interesting, isn't it? They didn't think, oh, a baby has been born. If they had, then they wouldn't have made that. If it was just a baby had been born, they wouldn't have made the journey. These were grown men. This is in days before you had new men. They weren't around at the births. They didn't go coo. They didn't change nappies. These were not that kind of men. That kind of man didn't exist in those days. Fairly new invention, and splendid too. They were looking for a king. And it was the fact that it was a king that was born that drew them. So immediately the New Testament kind of pulls the rug from under our feet if we think that the whole thing is just about a baby, and that's lovely, and it's any baby's birth is just as wonderful as this. There's something special about this one. It wasn't simply that a baby had been born. It was that a king had been born. And the reaction to this is very interesting. And as in all the reactions to Jesus, right throughout the four gospel accounts of his life, those reactions tell us something about ourselves. They all capture something about our own reactions. They are all expressive of the reactions to Jesus ever since. Well, how did they react? Well, in the first place, they left where they were and they made a journey. They went looking for him. They were seeking him. They couldn't ignore this king that had been born. Now, I don't know what goes through all our minds and our hearts to bring us to this church on an occasion like this. But maybe for us, we are in exactly the same position as these men. Now, it's interesting to note that they are men, of course. As a parish minister, sometimes, not so much here in Aberdeen, but previously where we were in Dundee, you'd go around to the homes of people who were church members and you'd knock on the door and the husband would answer the door and immediately say, you'll be wanting the wife. Like, you know, Christianity was something that men didn't do. But these men sought, and perhaps there are some of us here this evening who are seeking. And what we are seeking is not a something. We're not seeking some new philosophy of life. We're not seeking some new set of principles and rules by which to live. We're not seeking some new instructions. We're not seeking some new 7 of this and 21 of that that will transform and revolutionize our lives and turn us into highly effective individuals. We're actually seeking someone, not a something. And we're seeking someone because we know we need a person. And we know we need the love of this person. We know we need God. Well, the wise men went seeking. And they used all their wit and all their resources to make a journey. Not an easy one. They just hop on a coach or climb into a car. They made a difficult journey looking for a king. And they were looking for the king because of something else that was in their hearts that was a reaction to this king who was coming. They wanted to worship him. Now, the idea of worshipping a king was in some parts of the ancient Near East not unusual. But this is interesting. They didn't just go to give things. We read that when they found him, their hearts were filled with joy, and they, well, we read, bowed down and worshipped him. Very important people in the ancient Near East, as these magi were, didn't bow down in the way that you're told to bow down if you're presented to Her Majesty the Queen. If that's going to happen to you, then you just bow a little from the waist, but not too much from the waist, and not of the head, unless, of course, you're a lady, in which case you curtsy. Men shouldn't try ever to curtsy. It's just not elegant and doesn't work, and you look really stupid, and it wouldn't impress the Queen either. So, a bow. It wasn't like that at all. It wasn't a British bow. Vastly understated. And unlikely to do your back in for health and safety reasons, so that you can't sue Her Majesty for having you suffering from a disc problem. This was right on the floor, totally prostrate, as low as you could get, and it was all body language. The body language said that I am lower than you. The body language said you are in every way greater, higher, more important, more worthy than me. And so you got as low as you could, flat on your face. So these were men, educated, important. They'd made a great long journey. And we find them finding the child Jesus, filled with joy and flat on their faces, worshipping him. Now, the interesting thing about the worshipping is that these were men from another country. They were not before their own king. Most likely, if they came from Persia, they were in the presence of somebody who was another country's king. It was not at all required that they should bow down, that they should prostrate themselves. And certainly not required that they should worship him. Fine, you might deify your own king. Later on, not quite 100 years after this, it became fashionable to deify a Roman emperor. But it was the Romans who deified them. You see, they recognized, and it comes out in the next bit, they recognized that this was somebody not simply to admire, not simply to show respect to. This was God. And so they did what you do with God. They worshipped him. How interesting it is that we sort of palm Jesus off. We palm him off as a baby. We're suddenly, when it comes to the time of Jesus' birth, every year we're very interested, or we sort of prick our ears up at the thought of Jesus the baby. But they worshipped Jesus the king. They knew he was God. A man, yes, well, a little baby, human, but also God. What do we think Jesus is? You see, we do keep him at arm's length. We just palm him off with some interest. We say, well, yes, he's deeply influential. He's a tremendous teacher. He's a marvelous moral example. Shows us sacrificial love. He taught us all the good things that we want in our society and that we want for ourselves. But they didn't look for a teacher. They looked for a king who is God, whom they worshipped. It's very easy for us to keep Jesus at a distance with a few compliments, which prevent us from ever taking his claims seriously. And then the third thing that shows that, well, from their own scrolls and perhaps from their reading of the scrolls of the Jews that they would have been had access to, they really did understand not only who he was but why he came. And so they presented their gifts: gold for a king. It's what you gave a king. Frankincense. It was used in worship, and the idea was that as you burnt frankincense, then the aroma that came up would rise up in the smoke and would rise to God. It was sort of a picture of prayer and of worship rising to God and being acceptable to him. So they understood that he was God. And then this third gift of myrrh, which was typically a spice that would be used in embalming that would be done involving costly spices, that showed your respect and your reverence for someone. They knew he would die. And so these wise men sought him. Wise men still do. And they found him. This baby Jesus, later on, as he was teaching, would say, "Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Ask and you will receive." They sought and they found. Finding him, they worshipped him. And they offered their gifts to him. "You take what I've got." But there is, of course, another reaction. We're thinking of two reactions. There's the reaction of Herod. Herod, who perceived absolutely accurately that this king who had been born was a threat to him. In a brilliant short poem called Salus Mundi, Mary Coleridge writes this: "I saw a stable, low and very bare, a little child in a manger. The oxen knew him, had him in their care. To men he was a stranger. The safety of the world was there, and the world's danger." See, Herod rightly perceived that Jesus was his danger. Everything that Herod wanted to rule his own life and rule other people's lives, everything that Herod wanted to say, "I will be king of my life," everything that Herod wanted in terms of the world's power and influence and success was threatened by Jesus. There is no room for two kings on one throne. Herod did not want to yield either the throne or the rulership of Israel, but he did not want to yield the throne of his own heart. And so he wanted to get rid of Jesus, delete him, edit him out, wipe out the threat, eliminate it. And still, in our hearts, we hear and feel the echo of Herod, because he is our danger. This little baby, so meek and mild, this little baby that did not cry, apparently, according to a way in a manger, this little baby threatens our self-rule. This little baby, this king, threatens our self-enthronement. The wise men were not troubled by this. The magi happily got off their camels, if they were riding camels, and got off their thrones and lay down before him, worshipping him. Herod wanted to get rid of him. Where are we on that line between the two, the Magi and Herod? So the wonderful thing about Jesus is that he accepts us. The wonderful thing about Jesus is that he forgives the Herod in us. The wonderful thing about Jesus is that now still, he reaches out to us, calls us, draws us, pulls us. And if that pull is going on in your heart this Christmas, don't do the Herod. Let yourself be endangered. Do the Magi. Seek him. And you'll find him. And when you find him, worship him. And give him all that you are and all that you have. Which of them were the happiest? Herod or the wise men? Which of them were the most fulfilled? Herod or these Magi? Which of them had joy in their hearts? And which of them grew old, gnarled, and empty? May God grant us grace to be more Magi than Herods this Christmas. Let's pray.